Hey there, this is Justin with the HuffFinds Institute. Now remember, there'll be a question at the end of the podcast that, if answered correctly, could result in someone receiving one of the great-looking HuffFinds t-shirts. The catch? You need to be the first one to send your answer to huffinspodcast@hokn.tamu.edu.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. HuffFinds Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the HuffFinds Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the HuffFinds Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello, and welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast from the HuffFinds Institute. We're so glad that you decided to download us and join us today as we talk about sports medicine and all the varied aspects of sports medicine. We're very pleased to have today with us Dr. Carl Gabbard. Dr. Gabbard is a professor here at Texas A&M University. His specialty area is motor development. He is the past president of the National Association for Sports and Physical Education, and widely regarded as an expert in the field of childhood motor development. So welcome today, Carl. We're glad to
have
you here.
I'm glad to be here.
Super. The first question people are going to ask me is, what is motor development?
Oh, it's the study of how we acquire motor skills across the lifespan. And, of course, my specialization is infancy and early childhood. So, how children acquire skills, how they learn skills, how they coordinate their actions together.
Yeah. So they start acquiring skills like from day one, or when does that begin with infants?
Well, from day one, you hit it just right. I mean, we study the foundation of movement, of course, is reflexes, how a child moves. And from that, we get indications of the foundation that perhaps if there's going to be a problem. I also work with people on disorders. So if we see problems with reflexes or what we call spontaneous movements that an infant makes, we have some idea of their foundation of what they have at the time.
Right.
And then by 2 to 3 years of age, when children begin, as we know, to start walking and throwing and kicking, then we study how those skills are put together and coordinated. Trying to know that, as I tell my students, if we understand and know what's typically normal, then we'll have some idea of what's not normal. And that's what a lot of people and a lot of my colleagues are interested in, developmental coordination disorder. I typically have also studied the outcome of low birth weight infants born small for their age.
Right.
What's the outcome, the long-term outcome? We have a lab in Brazil because we have a lot of low birth weight babies in Brazil. Two of the ladies that are doctoral students with me now, in fact, that is where they're from.
Right.
So with that collaborative, we work and study the outcome of those babies.
So what is the outcome?
Well, one of the things that across the board the medical profession has found is fine motor control deficits and fine motor control.
Yeah.
So supposedly that low birth weight or preterm affects the neurological development of the infant. And that neurological development seems to transform more to fine motor skills.
So when you talk about fine motor skills, though, what are some examples of that?
The hands, digits, moving them.
Like writing?
Writing,
when it moves
for
into
sure,
handwriting.
In school. There's problems in school with that area. And as you know, as we age, when you see older people, in fact, one of the first things that goes, aside from postures, we know, is their fine motor control, the ability to write, to eat, to put a key in the door, those kinds of things. So that's where the foundation of this in motor development that I study. So, we like to study the home, too, what goes on in the home and and how we might enhance the environment to help children to have fine motor deficits.
I had a colleague once that used to work extensively with children with their fine motor skills, especially with writing, because he always said, if they don't have the fine motor skills, then they really can't be fully healthy.
That's correct. Well, that certainly affects the whole wellness of an individual. If they're not doing well in writing, they're not doing well in school.
Sure.
And as we know, that can perpetuate several different areas.
Well, and I think that's a shift for so many people when we think of healthy living. Many times people think of if you're fit and you can go out and run 20 miles or whatever. They forget about things like the fine motor skills, like riding, that can actually be a part of a healthy living, the quality of life kind of issue.
Well, manual control, and that's one of the things we study reaching a lot, but manual control is one of the highest investigated areas that we see.
Really?
You think of the use of your hands.
Right.
Is a daily thing.
Right.
I mean, you have to almost have your hands.
Right. Right.
And the deficits we see with young children with that, being able to button themselves, feed themselves, clothe themselves at some point. And then you look at the other side of the spectrum, which I'm a developmentalist. I'm on the younger side typically, but the developmentalist colleagues that I have that are on the older, advanced aging, we would say, think of the hands, how important they are.
Hmm.
Just getting a key in the door, just feeding yourself, shaving yourself.
Right, right.
Yeah, cutting your toenails, a colleague told me here last month, was one of the toughest things in the elder generation to do, is to cut their own toenails.
Wow.
I mean, you know, typically we don't think of those kinds of things.
Sure, yeah. We don't think of them until we can't do them.
So we study the development of that.
Right.
We study the how those things are acquired.
Sure.
In a natural way.
What would be some signs that a parent might look for as their child, you know, develops 2 to 3 years old, that maybe there's some motor development deficits that they need to pay attention to, you know, call you up and talk to you about? I mean, are there some specific signs that they should look for?
Well, typically clumsiness is one thing. You know, I mean, we all kind of have an idea of, well, my child's a little clumsy.
Right.
Or that person is clumsy. We may even say it to ourselves.
Right.
That would be a general indicator that you might want to ask someone at the school, you know, either the physical education teacher, and mostly all schools, there's a diagnostician.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, for the younger child, your pediatrician.
Mm.
I work with Scott and White, and I've worked with other people in the medical things and assessment.
Mm.
And that would be a sign. You see clumsiness, then you ask your personal physician or someone at the school that can really assess what's going on. And we do that here at Texas A&M. We do that quite a bit with assessment.
Now, can some of these deficits be overcome?
Yes, to a certain degree. Mm. It depends, of course, the severity of those, whether they're really a neurological problem or just a delay.
Mm.
Now, see, that's where a lot of times people are thrown off. My child is below, well, it may be a maturational process.
Mm.
Yeah, you shouldn't get too concerned for a while, but you should have that looked at.
Yeah, what's a while?
A 2-year deficit, anyone that, if there's a scale that they've been tested on and it shows a 2-year deficit, then you need to look something more specifically.
Yeah.
That's typically what we say.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, can physical education programs help these kids overcome some of their motor deficits?
Oh, there's no question about it. And the biggest one is just physical activity in general.
Mm.
And as I mentioned, you mentioned I was the president of NASB, but I worked with NASB for 6 years.
Mm.
First three, I was the chair of the Council on Physical Education for Children, and the last three as the president. And we worked very closely with David Satcher at the time, was the Surgeon General.
Mm-hmm.
American Heart Association, that's what we did at that time. And I was mentioning to some of your colleagues that I have a chapter I'm revising in a book that I have, Lifelong Motor Development. And from 2001, when I finished that, what has really happened?
Mm.
You know, we see so much in public marketing,
right.
You know,
right.
Eat right.
Right.
Play an hour a day. I mean, you see it all the time. So how much gain have we made? Of course, I think we've made some, but the statistics don't show that very well. There's some that are very alarming.
Now, is part of that due to the fact that physical education is being taken out of the school curriculum?
Yes. A good physical education program would certainly. As it is right now, in fact, I looked the other day, Texas has daily physical education.
Right.
But there are a lot of states
that don't.
Only less than 10% have daily. Daily.
And that's even for, like, elementary kids.
That's elementary that I'm talking about right there.
Wow.
Now, at the high school, they typically have physical education, but one-third of the people can get out of it for exemptions or, you know, the marching band. Don't get me wrong, marching band, drill team, but the idea, I mean, we've had that around for 60 years, right?
Right.
So,
right.
You know, why would we have adults that 65% are, that's the question, 65% of Americans are obese or overweight.
Right.
Number one in the world, in the industrialized world today.
So when we say number one, we really are.
We're number one. How can that be? You know, people ask me when I travel, especially in Europe, they would say, you know, we've heard this figure. Is that true? How can that be true? You know, when you, ideally or perhaps for real, we have the best athletic facilities and athletes.
Right, right.
So what is probably happening is we are not focusing or attending to that other 97% of us.
Yeah.
And that goes into schools as well.
But how come physical education is being taken out of schools? I mean, number one, I was a middle school teacher, and I can't imagine having a group of middle schoolers, much less elementary kids, that you don't give them a chance for recess or physical education or something like that. They would probably explode.
Let me tell you what the latest thing is that I just got not too long ago from an international congress. Recess is now going to be taken away is what they're looking.
Wow.
It's the same thing. They're looking for time.
Wow.
Everyone wants a piece of the time of the academic day.
What are they doing with the time?
Computers. Art. Gifted.
Yeah.
Talented kinds of things. So they all want a piece of that day.
I've heard some people talk about because we don't test for physical activity or physical education on any of the end of grade exams. That's one of the reasons that it has become devalued, because we don't test for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's become a requirement in more states.
Mm.
That's one of the things they've tried to do.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I know in the state of Texas that even if you are in the marching band or some other thing that's typically exempt, you still have to pass a fitness test.
Do many schools still do like the President's Council on physical fitness kind of test?
Yes. Most schools today, in fact, the most widely used is something called FitnessGram.
Mm.
And FitnessGram is one of the things that has come out of that is since principals are having a harder time justifying physical education, what they're trying to say is physical education is important to the overall wellness of a person as well as their academic performance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, although there's no causational kinds of things, there is some evidence to that. Two really big studies, one in California, here in Texas. The California study was over 1 million students in grades 5, 7, and 9 in math and science. The top 25% on the fitness gram were also in that top 25%.
So if they were better physical fitness, they did better in school.
Right. So the people ask the question like me, well, what's the reason? It's hard to say. There's no direct evidence. You know, we say blood flow, nourishment to the brain, you know, concentration, the ability to sit and concentrate, you know, and get those resources to the brain, maybe something with it. Self-esteem, when you feel physically fit.
Right.
Those kinds of things. I think it's an additive thing with several things.
Right.
But those children are typically more physically fit, tend to do better in school. Now, we know there's exceptions.
Sure.
Our athletes are not always the smartest ones in our class.
Right.
So it's not just a sport, athleticism.
Right. And that's a great message for our listeners to take away, and that is that physical activity, even if you aren't a gifted athlete, can actually help you in your cognitive types of pursuits and your educational pursuits, even when you're out of school, if you're physically active, that can help you with that. So we really, to kind of tie the loop together here, so we started talking about motor development and coordination, and you can certainly improve that through regular physical activity. And our children, the biggest societal institution that does that is the schools.
Right.
And so if they have physical activity there, then that can help offset some of those motor development problems.
Certainly can.
And which is another reason why physical activity and education is important in school.
I think one of the biggest questions, though, that one of the alarming things when I was looking at revising this chapter I told you about the other day is it was about 15 years ago when we started talking about this more. We've always talked about it, is that when children are, they're relatively active, pretty active up until they're about 12.
Right.
I mean, that's been around for a long time, and then they tend to tear off, look more like adults. So recently I took a look at that, and there was a study done. In 2009, this study showed the same thing, that the 6 to 11-year-olds were pretty active, moderate physical activity per day minutes. And right after that, the next section, it dropped almost in half.
It's almost like
from 95% to 45%. And, of course, males are significantly more active than females. You ask yourself, why should that be in this day and time? Especially when we're having a problem. So the number one question that I have, and I don't have the answer for physical educators, is how can we keep young people, especially females, active after 12? It goes in half.
It's like they hit puberty and it's just downhill from there.
That's it.
Yeah.
Well, some of it has to do with sports. You know, children are engage in sports. We want everyone to play. When they're 5 and 6 and 7, they have to play off the bench sometime.
Right.
And then it's kind of a attrition.
Mm.
Then in junior high, only the better play.
Mm-hmm.
Then you don't play, you just sit on the bench.
Right.
And then pretty soon you're up to that, you're disgusted, and then you don't play at all.
Right.
So what's your alternative?
Right.
So we need alternatives for people, physical education. The community and access is where I'm seeing a lot of work done, and I think it's going to turn it around. Communities now are making a concerted effort to have walking trails, to have at night where they're lighted for people, to have more activities for youth.
Right.
So it's not just sports.
Right.
See,
right.
Somehow we've missed the boat there.
Yeah.
And that boat is after 11, 12 years of age, trying to keep young people active, especially females.
Right. So what can we do?
You bring
a great problem, and there's so many people that are listening that probably had the same experience. Well, many people had bad PE experiences.
They sure
and,
did.
And I was fortunate to have good PE experiences, and that helped me with my field and where I'm at now, and I would bet you were the same way.
Right.
How do we help PE? How do we help physical education so that it's not a joke? You know, so many people use the term PE as a joke.
Well, I think the public announcement stuff that we've seen is at some time, it hasn't yet, going to take effect.
Right.
People are going to appreciate physical activity.
Right.
They're going to appreciate physical education.
Right.
That would be one.
Right.
Now, just because there's a physical education program doesn't mean there's the answer.
Mm.
Is it a good one?
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some reports lately that just because it was PE, I mean, what are they, playing dodgeball? Or are they actually teaching concepts?
Right, right.
So people know that these are things I need for flexibility, I need for cardiorespiratory fitness, I need for strength, and these are the activities that I can do.
Mm-hmm.
So to do those activities, then you have to have access after physical education.
Right.
Because to be very practical, if I'm in a school downtown Houston or St. Louis and I've got an elementary school and we've got 600 to 700 kids in our school,
right,
is it practical for me to have daily physical education for an hour for every kid? It's not. How many gyms would you have or how many people to do?
Sure, right.
So it's not real practical. Maybe 20, 30 minutes, so what do you do, right? For some schools, it's going to be practical to do that.
Right.
So you want to teach them the concepts, like we do at the university now, and then give them access. And access would be the community. I've seen some really, really nice things done at some communities.
Right.
You know, where they make a concerted effort to have youth sports or after-school programs.
Right.
And it goes to the family, too. We don't want to forget that.
Sure.
You know, the parents have time to get them there. That's
right.
Another issue, right?
Right.
Access and parents' involvement to get them there to do that.
I know one of the things my wife and I talk about is we talk about the shift of physical education out of the schools. We often talk about how the commercial sector actually seems to have picked this up, and you have a lot, as you just talked about, in the community and the commercial sector, you have a lot more after-school activity programs. It seems like our friends have kids that are running everywhere to this after-school soccer or basketball baseball or this or that. And I never had any of that growing up. I don't know about you, but it was always either in the school or that was it.
Right. Yeah. Well, we're seeing a lot more of that. But I mean, I can't help but wonder, why do I see these statistics that I see? Is that are they continuing it
afterwards?
After 12 or whatever?
Yeah.
Do they keep going with that? And do they enjoy it, you know?
Is there any data out there that shows that if children have PE for a certain length of time every day or activity, that they are more likely to continue to be active later in life?
That's a tough question because it depends on the program. Hmm. Minutes by itself really
doesn't do anything.
Someone could do a wonderful job in 30 minutes,
right?
You know, compared to being there an hour,
right?
You know, it depends on the enthusiasm, the kinds of, you know, what kind of access you give them afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
The general recommendation is that we see it, that young children spend at least an hour a day in activity, with a lot of it, quite a bit of it, being at least a moderate, vigorous activity. Mm. That means you get your heart rate up at least some. The schools have always said, NASPA and NASPE, there's two organizations there, I've always said 150 minutes a week of physical education. Well, that's 30 minutes times 5 days.
Right, right.
But it's really depends on the quality of that program.
It also comes back to there's a parental responsibility
as
well.
Definitely.
Right? I mean, I think that's, I'm not sure that my parents' generation, they ever thought about these things because we were, you know, they kick us out of the house and say, come back when it's dark.
Sure.
But nowadays in particular, I think there's a parent responsibility to make sure their kids are active?
But parents need to know why.
Mm.
You know, I mean, why is play important?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they play. You know, a lot of parents remember, okay, I played. I mean, why is it important?
Right.
Well, that's where the new stuff has kind of helped us, the idea of obesity. Type 2 diabetes.
Now, obesity hadn't helped us, though.
No. But the idea, that could be a consequence of being inactive.
Yeah, right.
And then type 2 diabetes that we almost never saw with young children below 12 years of age. And now we're seeing it in early teens.
Mm-hmm.
And typically that is associated with obesity and overweight that we wouldn't have seen before.
Right.
That's a big figure that's changed a lot. I see that young children that are more inactive where the studies are. The small couch potato kinds of things we see, bone densities are a problem, just like you would with adults.
Already in the younger children, bone densities are a problem.
Oh, already. Well, you see almost the same thing with children that you see with adults, cardiorespiratory, circulation problems, bone density, type 2 diabetes are two that have really. But the probably the real crux of it is, or message is that if we don't do something when they're younger and give them something, some tools to continue with,
right,
it's not going to be 65% that are overweight or obese in America. It's going to be like the Carnegie Commission and some people of Harvard had said, it's going to be 75% by the year 2025.
Right, right.
And that's pretty scary, and I thought, well, no, we're gonna nip it in the bud before then.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, our children are number 5 in the world.
In
the industrialized world in overweight.
So we're working on becoming number 1, though, it sounds
I
like.
Guess so.
Yeah. Not a good thing.
Italy's number 1.
Italy's number 1?
Yeah. Moderation. You know, we've kind of gone overboard almost everything.
Yeah.
You know, the soft, I'm not for a lot of soft drinks, don't get me wrong, whatsoever, but we've tried to find everything there really is.
Right. Right.
And instead of teaching children about moderation, is a hamburger and French fries or a Happy Meal a terrible thing? Is a soft drink a terrible thing? You know, too much, yes,
right,
certainly is. But we're not teaching so much; it's moderation.
Right.
And
right.
If you couple that with regular exercise, it could be okay.
Yeah. It seems like Americans want to make things too complex.
Yeah.
It really is simple. I mean, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have said that the number 2 actual cause of death in the United States is physical inactivity and poor diet.
Yes. You hit it right on the nose.
So if you're active and you eat well with moderation, and
right.
I think that's a key thing, with moderation, then you'll live a healthy life.
Right.
And that goes for your children.
But where do you develop those habits is the question.
Yeah.
You know, how young?
Right.
And then carrying those on.
Well, how young?
And we're missing a gap. You couldn't do it too young.
So you start with the first day.
Yeah, you could start right away as soon as they have the knowledge to understand 4 or 5 years of age.
So no soft drink for the young children. Right? I mean, I have friends who have been successfully raised their kids without letting them have soft drinks.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And that may be the best thing they've done for them.
Yeah, that's very true. So, that's right. Well, I think we're becoming more knowledgeable about that.
Yeah. Well, we're about ready. It's about time for us to wrap up as I look at the clock here.
Sure.
You have a take-home message that you'd like to give everyone?
Start early with your children.
Hmm?
Okay. And it has to be concerted, organized effort. What are they doing in the school?
Hmm.
What are the activities in the community? How can I help? Is it a good program that we have in the school? I want to know something about my child. I want to know, are they physically fit?
Right.
Could you give me something that I would know? How can I help them?
Hmm.
But it has to be a concerted, organized effort. It can't just, well, this is just going to happen on its own.
Yeah.
Because we're getting worse and worse. 65% of Americans.
And I think
I would have never guessed that would have happened personally. Yeah. I wouldn't.
I think we're finding out what happens if we just let it go.
True.
And without taking an active role in this. Incredibly important message, I think, to end with here. And I'd like to end with thanking all of you for being with us today and listening. And I'd like to thank Justin Dobson, our producer here, for keeping us on time and keeping our audio levels somewhat similar across the board. Again, we just invite you all to come to the HuffHeinzInstitute.tamu.edu/podcast. And if you haven't already, subscribe there. Sign up, and automatically every week, especially on Fridays, you'll get a new podcast. And you never know who we're going to be interviewing, just like we interviewed Carl Gabbard today, who brings us some important knowledge and information we all need to think about. So as we turn it over here to John for the closing credits, I just ask and hope that you have a active and healthy week. Thank you.
So this week's swag giveaway question is, according to Dr. Gabbard, at what point should we start worrying about motor deficits in our children? At what age should we start to be concerned? Email us at huffhinespodcast@hokn.tamu.edu.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Justin Dobson and licensed by the Huffhines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffhines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffhinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffhines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.